Sir, red light's on.
I was just reading in our... I never realized I read wrote this, but I was reading a paper I wrote in grad school about the advantages of a liberal education as opposed to a technical education. I said, rather naively, I think, that a liberal education gives you a broader range of tools to apply to a situation, whereas a person trained in a technical education focuses on the knowledge he has to try and solve a problem that may require a broader approach. And that's true generally. But I think we fool ourselves because my experience in Laos was we needed more technical expertise because the problems they needed solving were of a technical nature. Not high-tech technical, but as I alluded to before, 19th century engineering technical. They didn't understand water wheels. I built one, worked like a charm. Because I was in an area that had a waterfall. Mm-hmm. And I could build a waterfall, and I had enough men and a little extra money, and we built a way for the water to come down, cascade over them, turn a crank, and all that stuff. And I'm not an educated engineer or a trained engineer, but I have enough engineering that I could do that. Common sense, you know, nothing else.
What was the water used for off of? I mean,
it drove a rice mill. Free power. And I scrounged up an old transmission and a differential from a military vehicle, and we connected that to the water wheel and gave us a drive shaft and a gearbox, and we could have fun with it. And it worked. I don't know if it's still there, man, broken down. But,
it probably is.
But hey, it worked, and it was free, and it was technology they understood. When Gus and I were in public works, the OICC, Officer in Charge of Construction, that's a naval group, were overseeing some of the construction that we were doing to make sure it was done to spec and whatnot. And A decided they were going to build a hospital in Vientiane of the first class type. You know, pressure air, operating rooms, and, automatic gas systems, and air conditioning throughout the whole mall. And they asked Gus and I what we thought. And I said, forget it. What do you mean, forget it? We're bringing the modern technology, you know, we're bringing the latest stuff here. I said, hey, these guys can't even fix a flat tire. You know, nobody would believe us. Now, it wasn't that they didn't mechanically know how to fix a flat tire. They just didn't have any spare tires to put on the car, you know, or inner tubes or patches. They couldn't afford them. When a tire went flat, Laos, it was flat. And here you are talking about air conditioning units that cost $20,000 in 1974. And power requirements that they didn't have yet. They were getting it from the dam. It would be there soon. But they didn't have it yet.
Did they build the hospital?
They built this goddamn hospital. Concrete. Entirely air conditioned. And we left. Nothing worked after 3 months. Didn't surprise me. And I heard later reports that they jackhammered holes to get air in the damn thing. It was a coffin otherwise. In fact, the minister, when he came to my shop, he said, do you know anything about those air conditioners? I said, yeah, I helped put them in. He said, where'd you get them? I said, Bangkok. He said, you got them in Bangkok? They didn't even know where to get the parts for them. They had a grant from one of the countries to restore the hospital, but they didn't know where to get the parts. And the grant said, you tell us where they are, we'll buy them. Okay. So here's the minister, 20 years later, at my shop, here in L.A. You know where you get the part? He said, you go to Bangkok. Oh, okay. If you can get the parts now, because it's 20-year-old air conditioning instead.
Was there, of course, you were there 12 years. Did you get any sense that these realizations that you had were ever translated into policy over the 12 years you were there?
You know, you got frustrated because you felt that, and really I think our primary reason for being there was to support the war in Vietnam. We could have supported it probably better by having a realistic economic policy in Laos. But our policy in Laos was, okay, how do you keep Laos neutral, keep it in the war, so to speak, against the bad guys? I mean, don't forget CIA was operating in the northern part of the country, and southern part, the central part. A real economic policy for Laos would have been, in my opinion, infrastructure. And we did a survey. Public Works hired an engineer whose field was hydroelectricity. And he found 21 major streams that were exploitable. Laos could be today the economic catalyst for all of Southeast Asia, in that it has the only resource the other countries don't have, water power. It can generate enough electricity through the construction of, we figured, something like 28 major hydroelectric dams to provide energy for all of Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Burma, and Laos for the next 200 years. Now, these are major undertakings. In 1975, dollars is only like $15 billion. I have no idea what it is now. And the reason it's doable is because these dams would not flood arable land. Any dam in Thailand would flood too much arable land. In Laos, you're talking about mountains with vertical slopes.
They know what it looks like.
And the advantage here is that because the rainfall is so high, that you could have high dispensation. By that I mean, you can let it go out just about as fast as it's coming in without worrying about not having enough water. There was one area on the Plateau Bolivar in the south where there's a waterfall there that's 4,000 foot. Mm-hmm. I've got pictures of it.
Yeah, I've flown over the area, so I know what it looks like. Good. And it reminds me of those waterfalls that flow from those sacred plateaus in Venezuela, the
right.
back end of
Venezuela. Well, Angel Falls.
Right.
Now, we're talking, each one of those can be a hydro station. Or you can put a dam across the front of the wall and put it all through a penstock. And have a six... This guy was excited when I showed him this. He said, you realize what we can do here?
But it wasn't done. Why wasn't it done?
Well, partly of the war. I mean, the bad guys weren't about to let us do that. Because they were telling the Laos, we can do everything you need. But in reality, they didn't have the technology or the resources. I don't know why the UN doesn't do it. I don't know why there hasn't been formed a Vietnam, Cambodia, Thai, Lao consortium to fund it and do it. It makes sense for everybody. And you're talking about kicking the economy in the ass like you wouldn't believe. But that's what I mean about infrastructure. There is no rail system in Laos. Getting north to south is impossible. There are resources. The French never developed them. You know, after the French finally got out and other people came in, they found coal. You know, good coal. 20 miles from downtown Vientiane. The Lao never knew what it was. They didn't know how to use it. They knew it was there. But it wasn't any good to them. They didn't know how to use it. Of course, the French were mining tin out of the Taquet area for years and years. So the resources, there were, I read a survey and I can't remember what it said, but there were mineable sources of copper, coal, they had enough, they could make a cement plant. In fact, I think one was under construction. What I mean by infrastructure are those economic units that pay for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, electricity, roads, cement plants, using coal instead of timber to fire your boilers if you have to, or whatever.
So what was it like knowing that and
frustrating.
Building wells and sealed latrines?
Well, you know, when I was doing that, I didn't know that. You know, it didn't come to me until much later, and I thought I was doing something really wow. You know, I was. We were stopping the spread of disease. We were creating potable water. You know, making it easier. These guys were going to the river every day to bring water back full of this, that, and the other thing. And here they had clean water that they could bathe and drink without any problem. I mean, that was good, and it was necessary. But when you look at it, that's putting the cart before the horse. You can't afford that until you got the other things. Well, we were the afford, okay?
How much investment was there in terms of a local population? For example, if you built a well,
well, the villagers provided all the labor
mm-hmm.
and helped haul the sand and gravel.
Mm-hmm.
So it was one bag of cement made a well ring.
Mm-hmm.
So, and each well ring was a half a meter high. So two bags per meter, 10 meters, 20 bags. Okay? That was aid's input. The rest was theirs. Water seal privy was a half a bag of cement. We furnished that. They made the mold. We made the mold out of clay.
Mm-hmm.
I've got pictures of the IBS house. We had 20 molds being done at a time. It was picaresque, to say the least.
Let's say the well. What about the wellhead maintenance? Did the villagers take over that?
Well, see, these were hand dug, so there were no pumps.
Okay.
There were buckets down in the well, and
you
poured
them up.
That kind of thing. Now, we had another program. AID had a program, a drilled well program,
mm-hmm.
in areas where it was rock,
mm-hmm.
and you couldn't dig a hand-dug well. And we drilled the Public Works Division. They were under me, and wherever I was, we drilled, I'm guessing, 300 a year. And we maintained. Because they couldn't. I mean, there's no way they could afford drill rod. There was no way they could afford pumps and gaskets and things like that. So when they broke, they broke. And they were broke forever.
So how were they maintained? Did Public Works crews go out?
Yeah, but we were notified by the Chow Moon
mm-hmm.
that the well at such and such is no good. And we had a maintenance crew that went around and fixed them. We even brought windmills in to help. You know, use well rings and build a cistern, and the windmill would pump it full. The wind stopped, and the villagers would try to pump it by hand, and they couldn't because some of these wells were 200 feet deep.
When you were building windmills, did a local people ever cannibalize the parts of things?
Oh, yeah. All the time. What would happen first is the wind would stop.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no water. So then they'd disconnect the windmill and they'd put the handle on it. And that would, you know, you're talking 200 foot of rod, and that's a lot of work. It would work for a while, but you couldn't fill the cistern up. So then pretty soon it was just fill the bucket up. Then something would go wrong with a handle or something would break. And before you know it, well, it didn't work anyway, so we'll take the parts and use something else. Use them to do something else with, you know. Next thing you knew, you had knives or, you know, who knows what, you know.
To me,
infrastructure would have been, okay, let's get a blacksmith downtown and a machinist together and teach them how to make this goddamn pump. Because this pump is nothing but a piece of pipe and two cap screws and a piece of leather with a thing going on. That's it. And if you could teach the local guys to make them, then you turn it over to them.
Did it ever happen?
No.
Was there ever any effort to make the people responsible
for
the maintenance of the pump?
Sure.
But that didn't work either.
No money. Parts cost money. And since the parts were coming from the United States, they were expensive.
Because they weren't being locally made.
That's right. And, you know, I took over a refugee relief program and I quit Public Works because the chief of Public Works at the time was an alcoholic asshole. And I came to the personnel office and I said, if I quit aid right now, do I get my way home? And he said, how long have you been here? I said, over a year. He said, yeah, you get your way home. I said, then I quit right now. He looked at me and his name was Murdo. You can't quit. I said, yes, I can, and I'm doing it right now. Write it down. Do it. He says, why? I said, I'll not work another minute for that asshole that's the charge of Public Works. He said, well, cool down. Let me see what I can work out. 2 days later, I was working for Refugee Relief. And I started a program. All these refugees had metallurgy. You know, they were blacksmiths. They banged steel. Instead of handing them knives to make, to have, I gave them steel. Make their own knives. And they did. Not only made them, they sold them. And created a little enterprise there, you know. Gave them steel bars and they did their own thing. Which made more sense to me than buying the knives in Bangkok and giving them. You know, this way we're creating a little commerce. Well, the problem with aid, I'll let you know I'm a Republican, is that aid had a built-in antagonism for entrepreneurship across the board. So did the embassy. Entrepreneurial enterprise was just not their cup of tea. Developing local enterprise, local business, was not their thing. And anybody who was successful was suspicious. You know, if a merchant came in, or a guy who wanted to do something, oh, well, you know, he's cheating. There's something wrong here. So enterprise, allowing locals to embark and encouraging them, which is infrastructure. I'm talking infrastructure here. Mm-hmm. You know, you got to have machinists before you can run whatever you want to do. Because if you don't have machines, you can't fix what you put in. So why not help some guys start machine shops? You know, train them and fund them and let them go.
Was there any small business administration type projects for you?
There was an attempt, but it was poor. In fact, when I was having trouble with this, I wasn't the only guy having trouble with this guy. I went over and I said, look, let me join the Small Business Administration. Let's see if we get some woodworking going. See, I'd never told anybody I was a cabinet maker. I never, because I knew what would happen if I did. Mm-hmm. I would cease being an engineer and I'd be a goddamn cabinet maker. So I said, look, there are a couple of guys here in town that really have the business acumen and the skills to do something with this in an exportable way. Well, it turned out this guy Tata made a deal with the Japanese, and they did it. They put $1 million in equipment in his plant, and they were cranking out 300, there's one of them right there, tables like this mm-hmm. a month.
Did you say Tata?
Tata.
Oh, Arunkin.
Tata Arunkin.
Uh-huh.
He was Thai Chinese.
Huh.
And he had a plant in Vientiane. He's got one in Bangkok now. Mm. I was very good friends with him. Mm-hmm. Because I helped him. You know, technically I helped him get his plant going. And they were making these tables and exporting them to Japan. Aid never, ever did anything like that. It just had this, we can't allow anybody to make a profit. That's been the Democratic dilemma.
Well, the other issue, though, is that there's supposed to be a government-to-government aid system. If they start directly benefiting individuals that aren't clients of the government,
well,
the clients of the government will...
Well, that's true. But see, if you want to truly develop an economy...
Oh, yes.
You can't do it through a goddamn government, because that goes into a rat hole.
Right.
And if we haven't learned that yet, we better get out of the development business. Because governments don't do the developing. Individuals do. Entrepreneurs do. And I learned this real quick in Laos.
But not to any purpose.
Government wouldn't do anything. And it was a frustrating experience. Because any construction, we did it. I mean, Public Works was the CB unit of Laos. Mm-hmm. The two governments agree what the program was. Told us what they want, and we built it. Force account. Now, there was another side, that was the Travel Public through FAWA, Federal Highway Administration. They were working as counterparts, but they worked through the Lao government. Mm-hmm. Our organization, you need a school, you tell us where you want it, we'll build it. You want a hospital, we'll build it. Airfield, dam, you name it, we'll build it. We did some awesome things. It was infrastructure in the sense that it was needed. On the other hand, it was unmaintainable. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a village. We build them a six-room cement block school using sheet metal for a roof. Sheet metal's good 6-8 years. What happens then? They can't afford to replace the sheet metal. They do it somehow, but I mean, it wasn't easy. Simple things like hinges on doors. You know, hinge, $1 a piece, you know, $1 a pair, they didn't have that kind of money. So.
Well, let me ask you this kind of question so we can kind of move into the political.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think it's obvious that at the conclusion of this 2 hours, especially since you're so local, we might kind of talk about, wind up talking about the local development projects, and then I can come back and talk more about the difference between working for IBS and then working for USAID, because we're talking a lot. Those are going to become mixed because part of your career, but we can hone in on certain issues when we come back. If you don't mind, I'd love to come back.
No, that's fine.
Because 2 hours at a time is a lot of time. But since it's so easy for me, it takes me 20 minutes to get to your house from where I am.
Right.
So this would be great. But let's go to the point where you have arrived in the village. You have been there a while. You're picking up fluency in the language. You're learning how the system works. You're building projects, and you beginning to realize there are limited potential in the long run. But you're still with IVS. Now, are you going to? Did you spend the full 2 years with IVS before?
I spent 1 year in IVS at Boracon.
Okay.
And after, I think I was responsible for helping the construction of maybe somewhere around 20 wells. And I think everybody who wanted one got a water seal privy. Mm-hmm. Things slowed down, time to move on. So I was transferred to Ta Kek to start a similar project. The people there were not my kind of people. Let's take it easy, let's not push, I got very bored very quickly.
This is a more remote region?
Takek was a smaller village.
Right.
Smaller. It was a provincial town, mm-hmm. and I'd been in a village. And the people there were more laid back. I'm talking about the Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you think that would be so?
See, that was the thing. Everything was an individual thing. Mm-hmm. It's like any corporation. You got goers and you got doers and you got the others. And this area was a slow go. The leadership just wasn't. And I said, wait a minute. I can't handle this. So I asked for a transfer back to Vincennes and became associated with the area coordinator of Vincennes province, who had something like 40 unfinished school projects on the books. And he didn't know why, because he didn't have anybody to go out there and find out. Well, I went out there, and within 6 months, we'd finished all of them. Self-help. I mean, the projects weren't completed because the villagers didn't want them. It was just that nobody was out there to coordinate the doing. Mm-hmm. So working with the Public Works Division, whom I later became a member of, mm-hmm. I went to these places, say we need 30 bags of cement here, we need 50 of this, and I got into my Jeep, hauled it up there, showed them how to make the concrete, left an assistant there and said, okay, tomorrow I'll come back and see how we're doing.
Okay, let's run back on this so we get...
That was with IVS.
With IVS. So.
Yeah.
So you were, when you got to this provincial town, you said, well, gee, I don't feel I'm being any use here.
That's right.
But the person you're asking, you're telling that to, is an IVS coordinator?
He was actually the, I think he was the aid coordinator.
Okay, so you told the aid coordinator, I'm an IVSer, I'd like to be doing more things than this, can you arrange something? And they arrange a transfer down to Vientiane. When you get to Vientiane, who do you report to there? Was
okay,
it an
well,
IBS,
what happened was,
office? Or?
Yeah, what happened was I came into Vientiane on, for some reason, I told the chief of party, look, this Takek thing ain't working. Mm-hmm. Is there anywhere else I can go? Or, I can go home too. I was never one who mixed words. I was very frank because this was just an interim for me. I was going back to finish my doctorate.
Right.
The chief of party at the time, I think, was Walt Coward, or maybe it was Maxwell. And so he said, well, let me find out. And 2 days later, I was assigned to the area coordinator, Vincennes Province, as an IVS constructionist. And
so this is a USAID area
coordinator.
Okay.
Right. So I became
IVS
part of his staff.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he was my boss. Mm-hmm. I lived at the IVS house in Vincennes, and that I finished out my year there. we got all these projects underway. I can't remember exactly, but there were 30 or 40 of them. And one of them was, I never forget, was Bon Hot Khun Tha. Well, Bon is village. Hot means sandbar. Khun Tha is marijuana. So this is a village that grew marijuana on the sandbar. 10 foot tall.
That concept sounded pretty familiar to me. I was trying to figure out why.
They were always trying to shove that stuff on me. But in all the years I was there, I never smoked it. not one damn joint. Crazy.
That's okay. Because
it's not good for you.
It's not good for you. That's right.
So, and here was the ironic thing. Because I was working at Vincennes, I met the chief of public works in Pak Song when I was working in Mung Cao, because public works was supplying these metal forms for well rings. And I was on his ass. Every week I had a radio message. Where are the forms? Chief public works, where are the forms? He got pissed off, came down there one time to find out who this asshole was. It was bitching all the time. So finally we met. And I said, look, Mr. Cole, I'm here to do a job. You're here to do a job. Where are the forms so I can do my job? And we got them. When I came up to Vincennes to work on these schools, who do I have to talk to is Mr. Cole. And Mr. Cole was from the old school of construction. He did construction on the Dew Line in Alaska. Where everything was pulled in by D8 bulldozers. You had to set a fire under the damn thing so you could start it off in the morning. Toughest man I ever met in my life.
And he had to walk through the snow 5 miles.
That's right, every day.
Right.
But I learned an awful lot from that guy about handling men, organization. And working on this project, getting all these schools done. So how'd you like work for Public Works? I said, I'm not an engineer. He says, yes, you are. He says, I've got engineers. I just haven't got people to get work done. And he hired Gus, myself, another IVSer, Frank Bewitz. We're the only three with language capability and the only ones who enjoyed working out in the field. The other guys want to stay in Vincennes, you know, with the hot dogs and the Pepsis. I wanted to be out there with the action. Now, Frank is up in Montana teaching school, not teaching school, he's a maintenance guy for an Indian school.
But
he's changed his name.
Ah, because it didn't ring a bell,
He changed his name to David Duke. Now, you want to know something really weird?
Yes.
The deputy chief of public works' name was David Duke. Oh. His son is the David Duke of infamy.
So David Duke is the son of the chief of public works. Assistant deputy chief.
Right. Of public works.
Assistant of public works in Vientiane.
In Vientiane.
This was 1960.
This would be 70. Late. Understands why. I don't understand why. Frank doesn't tell anybody why. And Frank is a little. I love the man. I mean, don't misunderstand. Frank, Gus, and I have shared experiences that have bonded us for life. And even though I haven't seen Gus or Frank for maybe 20 years, I still consider them my best friend. But Frank grew up Jewish in Germany and survived the war in Germany. Mother put him in a rural farm area, and his father went to the gas chamber. From there, Frank went to Israel, and from Israel he immigrated to New York City. So Frank's a little twisted at times, but one hell of an engineer.
I don't know, this shouldn't actually mean anything to you, but you would never have encountered an anthropologist by the name of Felix Moos. You shouldn't. He was more in Vietnam, but he had a similar experience. So he wasn't Jewish, but they emigrated from, he went through that first, and when the CIA asked him to come out and work in Southeast Asia, he felt he owed it to his adopted country and found himself in Laos and in Vietnam.
Okay. Well, Frank was having, I was never quite sure. What I think happened is he was having marital problems, getting a divorce. He had a successful construction company in New York City and decided, screw it, and just left. Became an IVSer and disappeared. And I think part of the David Duke thing was to end the trail. Maybe. Also, I believe that David Duke and Frank were going to have some kind of business arrangements when they came back to the States. David Duke himself is a nice guy. He was an engineer, successful, neat guy. His son was twisted. David Duke II, or whatever. And this guy is a screwball. And he was in Laos. I vaguely remember meeting him. And total asshole. You know, what can you say? He still is. A man like that should literally be locked up, but we don't do that in our society, unfortunately, sometimes. But that's just a personal thing.
That's a personal thing. And so you finished out your year with IVS.
Right. That completed my 2 years. And Tom Cole of the Public Works asked me if I'd be interested. In fact, I was working for Public Works, really, before I finished IVS. Not only on this project, but Tom Cole got special permission from IVS to have me work at their maintenance facility. Public Works built, they call it the Well Drilling Center. And all the new equipment that came in was maintained there and sent out in the field. They needed a Lao-speaking help. I became the help. And 3 months later, I was running the facility.
A question.
With IVS.
Public Works, when you refer to Public Works, who's Public Works?
It was USAID Public Works Division.
Okay.
We were responsible for all aid-funded construction in country, except that funded by FHWA, the Federal Highway Administration, through Travel Public, the Lao Public Works. The Lao had their Travel Public, that was roads and bridges.
Right.
FHWA was counterparted to them. We were not counterparted to them. But we were responsible for all other construction.
Right, so you're not building roads as part of a federal highway assistance program to the Lao.
But we did a lot of force account roads. We built a lot of new roads. And we had several million dollars worth of equipment to do it with.
And you did that because, was it for your own equipment?
No, well, we did it with our equipment, our own men, because FHWA and Travel Public didn't have the manpower or the money to do it.
But it was servicing your other projects?
Well, it was a project. You know, build a road from A to B.
So occasionally you'd be asked to do that.
Yeah, and we built many hundreds of kilometers of road.
Okay, let's just pretend. Let's pretend you never did anything after that. You just did that first year with IVS. What have you carried? I mean, obviously, you stayed in Laos. Was there something special about that IVS experience that stood you in good stead?
I really think, you know, how many people ever get the chance to truly test their mettle? I don't mean just academically. I mean physically, endure, pull a group of people together or a pile of materials or a group of facts and come up with an idea. Very few. IVS gave me that opportunity. Had I never gone with IVS, I would have never ever had that opportunity. And I would have never gone to work for aid. That first year in IVS proved to me, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I was in the top 5%. Not just intelligence and academic, but I was able to pull things together and make things happen and make them work. And I did this with zeal, with an aggressiveness not most people encounter. In fact, piss a lot of people off. Because to me, I was very goal-oriented. Come on, let's get it done. What do you mean you can't get me the cement? Get the goddamn cement, you know. And I remember remarking once to a guy by the name of Galen Berry, who you should also interview. Galen was with IVS for a long time. He was also with aid. He did refugee relief work in Malaya and Thailand. Lao refugees, and he's local, Laverne. Whether he's in town right now or not, June Pulcini can give you an address and a telephone number.
Is that Berry, B-E-R-R-Y?
Yeah, B-E-R-R-Y.
Galen. Okay. Galen.
And I remember meeting Galen, you know, and he said, well, Howard, you know, we were talking about it. Well, you know, I got a few regrets. You know, I was a real son of a bitch. He looked me straight in the eye and said, you were trying to get something done. You know, he understood. A lot of people didn't. Well, it didn't really bother me at the time. And even today probably doesn't bother me. But when somebody threw a roadblock in front of me, man, I either went over them or through them. Never around them. And my first 4 years, really, with Public Works, I was a troubleshooter for Tom Cole. He'd say, okay, I want you to go such, such, and I want you to find out what the hell's going on, why things aren't moving, kick ass and get it going. And I said, well, what about the two guys there? He said, fire.
Well, when you finished with IBS, okay, and you have this sense of self, what was your, now that you're working for Public Works, did you have any direct contact with IBS people? How did you look at IBS staffers, okay, and personnel after you stopped working for IBS?
I got in trouble with them. Because to me, there was so much to be done. I remember I was on a road project up in northern Laos, a place called Ong Sao. And George Wagner and I were waiting for an airplane at the IBS house in Ong Sao. And the construction guy up there said, gee, I don't know what to do. You know, I'm so bored, there's nothing to do. I said, what? Within 2 minutes, I had outlined a year's program worth of work. He reported that to the IBS chief, who called my boss and said, tell Howard to leave our men alone. And I got reamed. Uh-huh. And I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Cole, I didn't mean to get you in trouble, but here's a guy telling me he ain't got nothing to do, and I'm giving him a program for a whole year, and he's pissed. Because to me, things, I mean, are so obvious. And here's a guy saying, I ain't got nothing to do. And I said, well, you're not looking real hard. I told him that. I said, well, gee whiz, you know, I've seen at least six things right now within 500 yards of this place that could be done. And the villagers would be glad to help you do them. Well, the bridge coming over the stream needed repair. And all that was cut down a few trees and make some, you know, repairs. Oh, well, if you don't know how to do something, you ask. You know, that's how I learned. And if you do know how to do something, you shouldn't ask. You just do it. That village was just really a neat place.
So what happened after that? You just kind of stayed away?
I stayed away from them. In Poxa, I stayed at the IVS house because it was convenient. It was near where my office was. I chipped in with the food and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then one day, a guy I knew said, Howard, you know, this just really isn't working out for us. I said, why? He says, well, you know, this guy's getting pissed off at you. And I says, why? He says, well, you know, your suggestions are not particularly liked, or words to that effect. And I said, really? I'm sorry. You know, trying to help you guys. Well,
just suggestions about the running of the house?
No, about, you know, projects.
Just sitting at the dinner table, yeah, and saying, have you guys thought of doing
this? You know, what about this and what about that? Mm-hmm. You know, hey, I saw this great project. Now, and look at, you could do. Mm-hmm. See, this is what, and I think Gus would agree, and I think Frank also. The group's coming in later, 3 to 5 years later.
Maybe so we're talking 69 to 75?
Yeah, we just weren't as technically oriented, perhaps. Not as infrastructure project oriented. Mm-hmm. More general. The guys that came over with me were technicians. Mm-hmm. And we saw things in, I don't want to say black and white, but I mean, this is doable, this ain't. Let's do it. What's the point of driving over a bridge that might fall down? Let's fix it.
So yeah. So evidently you didn't stay at the IBS house.
No, I got out of there. I finally said, you know, maybe he's right. You know, I can have more fun at the local bar than I can with these guys. So.
but after all this time in Laos, you still maintain touch with, let's say, Don Luce or IBS, or
well,
how did you
Don
maintain
Luce was,
your
yeah.
relations with
Don
IBS?
Luce was never was not
no,
there,
no.
But Chet Brown became the chief of IBS after, well, I was still in IBS. And we had a falling out. Partly because of what I suggested to this IBSer at home saw. That's none of Lewin's business. Don't keep butt out. I will tell IBSers what to do. Fine. I got serious shit. Seemed like I was always in.
I mean, because I always looked. In fact, I told area coordinator of POCS-A, Chris, graduate of Harvard Law, and he was with AID as an area coordinator. And I told him one day, I said, Chris, this is only a stopping point for me. You know, it's fun when it's no longer fun. When I don't think I can contribute anymore, I'm out of here. He said, well, me too. And I said, well, good. Then we can call it, you know, we can shoot straight, right? And that was always my attitude. And when AID in 75 said, well, we don't need you anymore, I said, that's fine. I'll leave here. Why go to Washington? So I took my reduction in force in Laos. Told my boss before I left, I said, look, you guys don't have more than 2 months. Pack your bags, because you'll be gone. I left on April 1st. They all left on May 17th. And I was, you know, it was fine. Because I couldn't see working. They said you could go to work with AID in D.C. I said, hey, I can't get along with the bureaucracy here. I couldn't handle AID in Washington. Well, that... I said, if you send me overseas, great, I'll stay, but otherwise, forget it. So I was never afraid of leaving AID, except in this sense. I knew that if I stayed more than 13 or 14 years, I'd get locked into the system. Oh, my retirement, you know, right? This, that. So I left, I had 10 years with AID. And I came home in 75, my wife says, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. So I interviewed with Kaiser Engineers to go to Iran. I engineered with Pacific something construction, building a project in Indonesia. And I said, you know, I've been overseas 12 years. It's time to go home. You know, enough. And that's what I did. And I told my wife, we're going home to me. She's English, so. Well, when did you meet her?
I met her in Laos. We were married in Laos.
You were married in Laos.
Married in Laos.
And so you came back to the States. What did you do for the next 20 years?
Well, the first 3 months, I just slept. I just slept. I was depressed and didn't know it. They didn't have a word for that.
They didn't have a word for that. Yeah.
And gradually, I decided that I thought, well, you know, I'd buy a house, remodel it, sell it, and buy another house, remodel it. And then I looked around at what these guys were doing here and around. I said, hey, I don't want my name associated with that kind of shit. Well, I'd always been a half-assed woodworker, so I opened up a cabinet shop. And that from that has evolved 5 other businesses that I have been fortunate enough to develop. I've invented tools that are in major national catalogs. I developed a lathe that I sell, tools for wood turning. I've become, up until about 2 or 3 years ago, I was probably one of the top 50 wood turners in the country. I mean, this is an invention of mine, this technique here.
The surfacing, that is more than that.
Yeah, that's a pretty awesome piece.
Yes. Holy cow.
Yeah. So I've done some very innovative stuff. I'm in a lot of galleries. I've been written in national magazines about what I do, and I've got a patent on a new tool that's coming out hopefully by the next 3 months that I'll retire on probably. Hopefully.
Cabinet makers retire?
Well, yeah. Well, retiring, you know, when I left Laos and people say, well, what do you do? I said, well, I'm retired. And they said, what do you mean you're retired? I said, well, isn't retirement doing something you want to do? And I will never retire in a sense where I just become a couch potato. But I want to pursue more of the art, and I've got a couple other inventions I want to work on. So, and that's another, that piece up there on the TV.
Uh-huh.
Not only the technique of laminating all that with the different colors, but the actual shape is original.
Yes.
So, you know, I've done some pretty interesting things. We were at a dinner party one time. June invited a bunch of us over and said, well, what was so special for you about Laos? And I said, well, I became a man in Laos. And everybody thought in the sexual sense. But no, I mean, when I went to Laos, I was 25 years old, inexperienced, young, naive, not a clue about what made the world go round. And after 2 years with IVF, and then certainly by 10 years with AID, I had become a mature man in all aspects. And when I came back to the States, I couldn't function very well because I was functioning in a society, in a culture that was totally different, alien to the United States. And it took me a good 3 years to reestablish a modus operandi here in the States. And I don't regret a minute the fact that I didn't finish a PhD, the fact that I never went back and finished, you know, the school. Not one second do I regret that 12 years in Laos. I think I would have regretted not having, but I would have never known. So the IVF experience for me, even though I was in trouble a lot, was just damn good. And the later experiences with AID just built on that. And there were frustrations, certainly. I think everybody had that. But generally, it was a wonderfully positive experience for me. And Gus and I have talked about this. And he feels the same way. Gus was Harvard School of Design, and he gave that up to go to Laos. He had, in fact, he tried to go back. After IVS, he went back for a semester. And said no. Mm-hmm. Came back to Laos.
Do you think that any, I was just looking at that, do you think you bring something of Laos into some of your work?
Everything I do. And it's totally unconscious. Mm-hmm. Things I've designed. It creeps in. And it's a really nice, subtle, I don't want to say nuance, but it is so subtle. It takes a practiced eye to see it. And I don't see it all the time myself. But somebody will say, God, that's got just a little oriental. I go, oh, really? Well, these lamps, for instance. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
One of the first things I did when I came home. In fact, I got somebody who wants to look at these. But most of my work is at the shop. And I don't really have a lot because I'm moving things, so a lot of stuff's in galleries. But it is amazing how it creeps in.
Well, that is just great. Actually, that's about I had this experience scuba diving. The very first time I ever scuba dived was the kind of thing where someone shows you how to use the equipment, holds your hand, and you go under the water. And it was in a coral reef off Fiji, which has actually. The Fiji area has the largest amount of fish plus the number of species of coral in the world. It's kind of a meeting point right there. And that will be the greatest dive that I've ever had in my life. And I've dove everywhere. But nothing is going to be, and not just because it was the first time.
Well,
it was a spectacular experience.
Right.
And I think this interview went that way. Right down to the last 2 seconds here. It is really covered everything, probably. What I'd like to come back and talk to you about generally is about a little more about your impressions of the Lao government in those days, some of the politics of Laos as you remember them, the USAID experience in Laos generally, which really isn't so much about the IVS, but I want to put as much USAID in Laos onto the record so that when we go through all these other people who have other experiences with USAID,
right,
that we have a reference point, things to talk, because they're all going to refer to that. All the, by the way, it's a, actually there are more people in Laos that responded thus far than IVSers in Vietnam.
I would think so. See, yeah, the experience in Vietnam for most of them was bad.
Mm-hmm. And it was
real bad.
But the numbers were disparate. That is, there were so many more in Vietnam than in Laos. And the result of that is that if we're going to spend a lot of time with the Laos experience, that record would better be as full as we can get. And you have an interesting experience. You work both sides of that street, but on the other hand, from what I've gathered from what you've said, the political end of USAID was a little bit more distant. You were getting down on nuts and bolts. If someone said, well, don't you think you're an agent for counterinsurgency, you'd say, I'm a road builder. And others felt differently. I know I'm going to speak to Fred Branfman.
Oh, well, Branfman's a cuckoo.
Yes, and Fred has extremely strong views. In fact, so much so, he almost didn't participate in the program.
You got to throw out, when you talk to that man, you got to throw 99% out, because he is twisted. And everyone who knows him knows that.
It'll be, the point is that because he's participating, though, we'll have this rather full, and the more talk to everybody, the better off it's going to be. In fact, he wrote to Don and said, I don't know what these guys are doing. I'll take your advice on whether I should participate or not. And Don said, look, I don't know what they're doing either. And we'll see how it works out. And but the thing is, it turns out that Don's big thing, really, the most impressive thing that happened with Don, besides writing that letter back in the thing, was when he became involved with the congressional committee that went out to Kung San Island, and they discovered the tiger cages, and this, in a sense, put the nail in the coffin in terms of the American public on Vietnam in many ways, or at least according to Frederick Nolte or somebody. I don't know what the story was about that. But anyway, it turns out I know all the people who were on that mission, including a Pentagon colonel who happened to be there and all these other things. And so when I was talking to Don, it was interesting because Don has very strong political feelings.
Oh, yeah.
But I would
never
put him in, he's in a different category than a lot of both left, extremists on either side.
Well, Don
and
has
that's
a...
that's fortunate to have that person.
Well, he has a reality, too, because he's been there.
Yeah.
You can't talk about Vietnam or Laos in real terms if you haven't had the experience there. And a do-gooder type, extreme liberal, goes to Laos, they're going to run into shit real quick. And there were a few of those in Laos, and Branfman was one of them. He still hasn't got the message. Reality is. And you can wish it away, but it ain't going to go away.
But what about his concern? I'm sure this is something that drives him, is the sense that USAID wasn't as frank as it could have been in assisting IVSers in being aware of some of the dangers that they were in.
I think that's bullshit.
Okay, so, well, Fred has a feeling that by not, because IVS never built enough links with Pathet Lao, that endangered some IVSers and led to their...
Every area I worked, it was easy to let the Pathet Lao know who I was, mm-hmm, what I was doing, why I was doing it. Mm-hmm. All you had to do was sit down with a local Naibon. Mm-hmm. And say, look, I'm helping you build this road. When the road's done, I'm out of here. If you don't want me to build a road, I will leave. I will tell my boss that it's not practical to build a road here. We were building schools down in Pak Say, and the only hardwoods left we're in bad guy hands. And the sawmill said, look, we can't get this wood unless the PL let us. I said, I'll make arrangements. All I did was tell the Naibon, you want the school? We got to get the wood. This guy's got a truck. You tell him where to go, and it worked. Mm-hmm. I had a carpenter tell me he was working on a school in Bad Guy Lane. And we knew it was a Bad Guy Lane. And he said, boss, the Bad Guy Colonel come up to me, he says, hurry up, I want this school. And my guy's pounding the nails faster and faster and faster. And yeah, this happened. You know, Gus was telling me about it. He was leaving a village as the bad guys were coming in. Other times he was coming in as they were leaving. These people orchestrated it. And if you've listened to what they said, no one was going to get hurt. But this guy, Chandler Edwards, down south in Champasak, was told by his Nibon to get his ass out of there. He didn't. He was wasted. This guy that Gus tried to warn, nailed a damn note on his front door, get out now. Not tomorrow, now. The guy stayed one night, he was wasted. The chief of IBS, Harvard grad guy, ex-Peace Corps, in the early 70s, I can't remember his name. He was wasted. He was in a territory he was told not to go into. It turns out, one of his buddies that I met in Bangkok in the 60s is my daughter and kids went to school with, his kids. Mm-hmm. And we talked about that. I met this guy in the Peace Corps hospital in Bangkok. My next door neighbor, a cross street neighbor over here, when we first moved in here, you know, our kids were young, his kids were young. So my wife was doing something, his wife was doing something, so we were babysitting. So we could start comparing notes. He was a pilot off a carrier, Tonkin Gulf. I said, oh yeah, where'd you fly? He said, Laos, you know, here, there, everywhere. I said, we're in Laos. And he said, you got a map. So I pull out a map and he says, well, we bombed the shit out of this place. He said, we bombed the shit out of this place. I said, yeah, I know. Those were my bridges.
Thank you very much.
So, and Gus and I were sharing some real sad stories. I mean, I've got some of these written down. I was starting to get some flashbacks on some of the nastier stuff. So I started recording them to get them out of my system.
Mm-hmm.
Gus was telling me about one where the Navy, or maybe it was out of Ubon or Udon, one of those places, dropped bombs about 100 kilometers short of their target onto a Lao village. Just wiped out 31 houses and killed 40 or 50 people. And Gus was given the unenviable task of rebuilding all those houses. Of course, the villagers hated his guts.